We'll hear arguments first this morning in Christ against Klein. Mr. Keller, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, you'll recall this matter was remanded to be rebriefed and re-argued on two expanded issues, and the first issue is whether or not the federal rule that jeopardy attaches in jury trials when the jury is sworn is constitutionally mandated. I think after reading the briefs in this thing that we can fairly well agree without arguing that at the time of the Constitution it was not constitutionally mandated and it was not a part of the Constitution. There were two common law rules at that time, Lord Cook's rule and the double jeopardy rule. And when we get to as far as Perez in the Touchstone case of manifest necessity says this is not a Fifth Amendment consideration, this is not double jeopardy. Perez was going into the question of whether or not it's permissible to take away that defendant's right to a jury. Once the jury is impaneled and sworn, Lord Cook's rule made it mandatory that you go clear through the verdict. But it clearly at that time was not a part nor considered a part of the Fifth Amendment. It doesn't become that until in various jurisdictions, in construing the rule of practice or Lord Cook's rule, there were dismissals. There were improper dismissals, and they held the improper dismissal to be tantamount to a jury verdict. And as a consequence of that, then there was jeopardy under the Fifth Amendment.
And in the original concept of the common law, there could be no such thing as a failure of a jury to reach a verdict. Isn't that correct? They'd lock them up on bread and water and they would come back with a verdict one way or the other.
This did happen, yes. You don't see any changes in that until Blackstone does bring out the words whenever there may be evident necessity, but it took a real necessity. A juror had to die. Hung juries are the things that gave them all their problems.
There was no such thing as a hung jury in the concept of the early common law.
No. Ironically, in the Commonwealth case, Commonwealth against Clue, in Pennsylvania, and I'm talking about cases that were all decided back between 1800 and 1820, they upheld Lord Cook's rule, and that jury had gone 36 hours, 24 without food or drink. Two jurors, 75 years of age or older, who had just gotten out of the hospital were in trouble, and the doctor looked at them and said, if they have some food or drink, something, they can go on. So the judge permitted the jury to vote on it, and the jury said, no, don't give it to them. And obviously they had them hanging on the ropes. And the judge finally let them off the hook and dismissed the jury, and that Pennsylvania Supreme Court held, no, this was improper, and freed the defendants. They ought not to be. And they took a strict reading of Lord Cook's rule. This gets commented on not only later by me, but when I start talking about the Arizona against Washington case and the wonder of whether or not we even ought to be here today in the face of that case, that opinion. But that case recites the reason why you don't keep a jury under that pressure, and certainly is a humane thought on it.
Was there an earlier time when, even after an acquittal, prosecutions were brought again and again until...
This is recited back during the reign of the Stuarts, Mr. Chief Justice, and Lord Cook's rule would have come down early in the 1600s. And between that time and 1688, you would have had the reign of two kings, the Stuarts. And at that time, yes, there were re-prosecutions until the prosecution could get a sufficient case together, and it was horribly abused. The history as I read it is as of the revolution in 1688, they went back to Lord Cook's rule, and we didn't have that occurring anymore. The second part of your question is, if there were an acquittal, would there be a re-prosecution short of the reign of the Stuarts? And I don't know the answer to that, because that comes out in the Arizona case that we know of no time when there was ever an acquittal and a re-prosecution. And as a consequence of that, whether it was by rule of court or whatever the rule, as a consequence of the acquittal, then the double jeopardy application of the common law came into effect. And I can't answer. I know of no case where there has been an acquittal and a re-prosecution, but I wasn't researching from that standpoint either. When we researched this and found that the time of jeopardy at the common law is at the time of the verdict of the jury, there wasn't any question in our mind, one, nobody today is going to go back that far in time and say that jeopardy does not attach until the time of the verdict, as it was at the common law. And we felt that for the simple reason that we've had too much law since then, particularly combining manifest necessity with double jeopardy, and two, fundamentally it was just unconscionable that you can put a defendant to the blade, you can commit his defenses, and still not say that jeopardy attaches. But we had real problems in briefing this, in getting the vehicle to come forward from the time of the judgment up to where we want to be today. We didn't know what the vehicle was. And then came Arizona against Washington, and the vehicle is the valued right concept. Downham, in 1963, Justice Tuttle in the Ninth Circuit in this case said that Downham necessarily has to stand for the proposition that jeopardy attaches at the time that the jury is sworn. And the reason that Downham stands for that is because that case involved a case where after the jury was sworn and before the first witness was sworn, the case ended. They didn't have their witnesses for counts 6 and 7, and the trial was terminated. And from that, Justice Tuttle says, Downham necessarily stands for this position. And I submit that when you read Arizona against Washington today, you have to come out with the same conclusion. Arizona against Washington said this was an improper opening statement by counsel, in this case defense counsel, but made at a time between the swearing of the jury and before the first witness. The fact that two witnesses testified in that case are really incidental to the opinion. The rationale is the valued right concept goes back to the time of opening statements, and that of necessity is before the time that the first witness is sworn. So reading this case, as you read Downham, you have to say Arizona against Washington stands for this proposition. And that means that the only thing that we can really argue today to this court is that we don't feel that the valued right concept means all of that, and we're not sure that that's what this court meant when it said that. And the reason that I say that is that this court was particularly careful in the opinion not to say that. Arizona against Washington was argued the day before we argued the last time. So it was pending during the time that our case is pending. Much of what was said in Arizona against Washington comes out of the briefs that we submitted in this case, so that we know that the court was conscious of this case when the opinion was written. And yet the court assiduously did not say jeopardy attaches at the time that the jury's sworn. So we don't know what we're talking about in terms of valued right as the vehicle for bringing jeopardy from the time of verdict up to some starting point in time. If you read the reasons for the valued right in the Arizona case, then you find that it's to avoid financial and emotional burden. A retrial would cause this. You find it's to avoid the prolongation of the period of stigma, and it may even enhance risk that an innocent defendant may be convicted. That means, if you read it literally, you could even be going back to the time that you first select the panel from which you're going to voir dire. We don't know where the starting point is on the valued right concept. We do know, it also has been argued under the valued right, that this valued right is a right to a particular tribunal. And that's expressed as early as 1840 in United States against Shoemaker. It's Lord Cook's rule. You're entitled to this panel, this particular jury. And it also has been argued that the valued right means that anything that goes to that jury, whether it's in the voir dire questioning, whether it's in the opening statement, anything that does something to that tribunal makes that tribunal valuable. Surface, United States against Surface, held that the constitutional policies underpinning the Fifth Amendment are not implicated until jeopardy attaches. Surface also held that this court has consistently adhered to the view that jeopardy does not attach until the defendant is put to trial before the trier of the facts, jury or non-jury. And then Surface held in two different places, without risk of determination of guilt, jeopardy does not attach. Now, if we read the Surface case in conjunction with Arizona against Washington, then we're saying that clearly jeopardy does not attach before the time the jury is sworn, and no later than the time that the first witness is sworn. And we've at least narrowed it down to that point. If we go back to those points then when we talk about the financial and emotional burden that was expressed in the Arizona case, that's not applicable to that narrow period of time. What difference are we talking about in finances or emotions between the time the jury is sworn and the time the first witness is sworn. The second reason given is the prolonging of the stigma. And that distinction is gone. Surely we're not talking about a prolonging of a stigma between the time the jury is sworn and the first witness is sworn. And the last is enhancing the risk of conviction of an innocent man. And that can't happen until the first witness is sworn.
In Montana, is it customary for both counsel to make their opening statements before the first witness is called?
No, sir. And I want to get to that. And the unfortunate part about it, and that's where you have all of the advantage, I can only tell you of my practice in Montana, and it is 20 years of trial on both sides and on the bench. And it's uncommonly rare that defense counsel says anything in the beginning. I have never heard a defense counsel say anything in the beginning that the prosecution didn't already know. The only thing that they say is something they want that jury to hear, which the prosecution already knows. And they want the jury to keep a fair mind on something, an open mind, because the assorted facts come out.
Sometimes they want the jury to focus on one point.
That's conceivable. You usually pick that up in the voir dire, to tell you the truth. I do. It's there. That's right. But at least we have reached the point that we're not going to hold constitutionally that somebody's entitled to anything less than a fair jury. So what you've done to that jury in the voir dire isn't something that's entitled to protection. And this gets to the point that I was reaching. The real concept of a valued right to me is any trial lawyer knows that when that defendant goes through a retrial, let's say a hung jury, so we don't have any problem there, he really has the odds against him. This was brought out in the Arizona case by Judge Leventhal in the Carsey case, and Judge Leventhal pegged it. The second time through, those witnesses whose weaknesses were developed by cross-examination by defense in the first case, they start to shore up their testimony. It's not a significant alteration, but it's there. And I have yet to see the defendant go through a retrial that everything didn't change. All of his surprise is gone. The prosecution knows where he's gone after the first dry run. The prosecution doesn't know that in the first case. They have to be prepared against anything this defense counsel will do. The second run, there's no spontaneity, there's nothing. That defendant has an impossible burden that second time. He really does. And this is the reason why I thought about this after the argument last time. You know, I argued to you then that as a matter of law and as a matter of fact, that defendant is not in jeopardy until something comes out that makes out a prima facie case. And I was arguing from surface, that without risk of determination of guilt. But I thought about this afterwards, and I thought, you know, really, from the time that the defense counsel makes his first objection or does not make his objection as a matter of strategy, that defense is committed. That's when they've really gone in and exposed their hand to the prosecution. And from that point on, that defendant does have a valued right to get this matter heard by this jury, by this judge, by whatever. Because now, for the first time, when he didn't have to, he has tipped his hand. And now his concern, his interest is there, is important. Or as was said in Jorn, in defining the same valued right, if the right is valued, it's because the defendant has a significant interest in the decision of whether or not to take it from the jury. And I submit until the time that the defense counsel has done something in this case that tips his hand to the prosecution, up until that point, it's not the type of interest that's so significant that deserves constitutional protection. But from that point on, it is. Rather than try and find out in any given case when that is, then at the time evidence is given, is, you know, it's right after that in any given case.
But it could be if, against the usual policy, defense counsel makes his argument to the jury.
It certainly could.
It could. And then he is committed.
That's right.
That would be a committal, wouldn't
it? That's right. The problem with that rationale is I just, one, don't see them
do it. They don't do it.
But if we're going to say that that's what it takes to put jeopardy, I expect we'll start seeing it. But that same defense counsel could tell the prosecution 3 weeks before that, this is what I have up my sleeve. And I can't imagine him telling it to him 3 weeks before any more than I can see a competent defense counsel tipping to the prosecution.
Well, I think the difference is that one is in the presence of the court and he's stuck with it. And if he just tells the prosecutor, he's not stuck with it.
Oh, I see what you mean. Well, that's true.
Wouldn't it be?
Yes, yes, that clearly is. He could do it for the record 3 weeks
right.
before if he'd want to. But as a practical matter, no, he really doesn't. And it isn't a case of giving the prosecution a week to get ready. No defense counsel gives the prosecution 5 minutes to get ready. If they can avoid it, you don't tell them something they don't know until it's your turn to put on your case, and then it comes. And I just simply, and I have to speak empirically, I don't see defense counsel telling the prosecution anything any sooner than they have to. And when they make an opening statement, they don't tell them anything the prosecution doesn't know. They're just telling a jury what to expect. But the prosecution knows this.
As I understood you earlier, you told us that in your state of Montana, it's not the practice to have opening statements.
No, I didn't answer that properly then, Justice Stewart. It is, but not at the time of prior to the taking of testimony. The defense counsel usually reserves his opening statement. He has the right to make it then, and he says, I'm going to reserve. Mm-hmm. And when the prosecution has rested and the defense is now ready to open its case, then he makes his opening statement.
Prosecution witnesses have all testified and the prosecution has rested,
case in
then the defense counsel makes his opening statement to the jury.
That's correct. Now, he has made it before, but he has never. I've never heard him make it that he tells the prosecution anything. Mm. It's only for the benefit of that jury going through this particular. The defense knows what the prosecution's going to give. If he did his homework at all, he knows what the witnesses have. And he's telling this jury at that time what to anticipate and, in essence, to keep your mind open. But he's not telling the jury anything that the prosecution doesn't already know. And it's that tipping of the defense that I think makes anything subsequent to that valued to that defendant.
When, if at all, Mr. Keller, does the prosecutor make his opening statement in your practice? In Montana.
Well, he makes his statement as such after the swearing of the jury and before the swearing of the first witness, but there is, in various jurisdictions, various judges before the state, there is some opening remark made at the time you first picked a panel of 24 that you're going to cut down to 12 so that they at least know who the defendant is, what he's charged with.
Well, that's part of the voir dire,
that sort of thing,
isn't it?
Yes,
so
really.
So you can ask him, do you know the defendant or this?
And the prosecutor who starts first may well be the one. The judges don't enter that actively in the questions. The parties do it, as distinguished from federal court, where the judge literally conducts all of the voir dire in our state.
Well, don't the Montana judges, at the time of the filing of the veneer into the box, make some very brief statement that this is a criminal case and such and such is the charge and that
yes,
sort of
sir.
Thing?
Yes, sir. And it varies with judges. Mm-hmm. Almost all of them do at least that. Mm-hmm. Some will go through a preliminary half dozen questions. Do you know any of the keys of the counsel and the parties? Do you know them and that? And get those questions out of the way in general. And if they do, they hold their hand up and they leave it up to counsel to interrogate further. But
and Mr. Keller, when actually is the jury sworn? After selection or is the panel sworn?
It's initially sworn when it's picked to tell the truth as to the answers that are given, but when that's the whole panel.
That's the whole venari.
That's
panel.
Correct.
Mm. That's and before the 12 are chosen.
Exactly.
That's only to tell.
Now the 12 again, after the 12 are chosen, are they then
again sworn again? Sworn? Yes.
And that is to well and truly try.
The case. That's right. Yeah.
And what we're talking about is
if three times you swear them, the first swearing is that they're going to tell the truth as to the questions asked generally as to whether they're qualified even to be jurors in general. Then they have another oath that they're going to answer the questions asked in this particular cause by counsel as to their respective qualifications.
Is that each one individually does that? Do you swear each one individually?
No, sir. No, sir. Never. In fact, it's a matter of practice. You swear everybody in the courtroom the first time. It's the first time they've been down to court, and they have to be qualified. Okay, then from that, you pick your panel for that day, and then you usually pick 24 for a trial of 12 because you have enough preemptories going in there. You want to be, when you're all done, you want to have 12 left. You have 20 in there, take it back. And there, they stand up and take the oath, but so the remaining jurors in the courtroom who may well be called into this case if somebody's out for cause. And that's to answer the questions in this case. But when you finally get the 12 and the alternates, if there's going to be any, those 12 or 14 stand up and now are sworn a third time.
But this first oath is essentially like the oath given to witnesses, merely to tell the truth.
Yes, sir. The first two oaths are that. And I don't think anybody's ever contended they have anything to do with what we're talking about. We're talking about swearing this final body of 12 to.
And that's that is the swearing that it is claimed jeopardy attaches.
That's correct.
Only there, not the.
That's the one I've surely construed to mean. That's historically, that's the time when that jury sworn.
Well, some of our youth that jeopardy ought to attach earlier.
Yes. Yes, because of what is said to that jury in the voir dire, that it should.
Exactly.
Yes, and our position on that is consistent with the Arizona case, and we cited in our brief, Morris, you're just not entitled to a prejudiced jury. The real function of the selection at that time is to come out with 12 jurors that are fair-minded and impartial. And it may well be that as a defense counsel, I'd like to have some sleepers on there. It may well be as a prosecutor, I'd like that, but it's a far cry to say that it's entitled to constitutional protection. So, theoretically, we're supposed to be coming out with 12 impartial people, and we have no particular interest in that tribunal other than the fact that they be impartial. Yes.
Keller, you've indicated that it would make sense to have the point at which jeopardy attaches be when the defendant has committed himself or when it makes a difference to the tribunal. Are the reasons for moving the point at which jeopardy attaches back from the present rule that it attaches when the jury is sworn back to there significant enough to overcome the interest in having settled law remain clear and definite and certain? There's some advantage. Everybody now knows what the rule is. Do you think it's the change?
Settled law didn't become settled law.
No, but it settled today, I would
until think. 1963, well over a century and a half, almost two centuries after we started. Wade against Hunter first enunciated the valued right concept a century and a half after we started, and, I might add, in a non-jury case. And now it's settled, but it really didn't become this till 69 because it wasn't settled in Montana. It wasn't settled in any of the states until Benton against Maryland in 69. It's settled in the minds of the federal judiciary because it's been around for a long time. But it hasn't been with the others. As far back, or as recently, as 1935, the ALI is recommending that jeopardy not attach until verdict of the jury, where it was in the beginning. So
well,
to us, it's not settled. And our question is, have we afforded protection for this defendant under any guise by saying it attaches at the same time as it does in a non-jury case? Excuse me, sir.
Well, as I understood you, your point is that the this point of law, that something happens when the jury is impaneled and sworn, it wasn't ever really part of the double jeopardy clause at all. It was part of quite a different rule that a person is entitled, once a jury is impaneled and sworn, to go to trial with that jury and to go to a final conclusion of the trial.
Civil or criminal.
Civil or criminal, and that's a different, has a different origin from the, from and is unrelated
to
the
double
jeopardy clause.
That's correct.
Mr. Keller, getting back to when you were a judge, I think more so than the jury, couldn't defense counsel commit himself on cross-examination?
Yes. That's why I agree with the rule attaching with the swearing of the first witness, because I think when that first witness, the prosecution, starts to testify, the defense counsel commits himself by objecting, even before cross-examination, by objecting to a question or, for strategy reasons, not objecting to testimony. At that point, he is in this thing, and that's why I don't have any objection, and I don't mean it really because of Montana's statute either. Sure, I want to see. I think we have afforded protection, but just in terms of trying to figure out where this ought to be and be something that's going to protect the defendant's right across the board, not just in a given state, I can see it attaching that soon because at that point the defense counsel is starting to put something into this case that he doesn't want to have. He's tipped his hand. If he goes a second time, it's not going to be that way, and I know it's not going to be that way. Judge Leventhal pegged it, and I think any of us that have tried cases know Judge Leventhal has pegged it. That second run is horrible.
How about real easy?
Real easy.
Yeah, when he committed himself, when he moved to suppress the trial.
No, he really doesn't. Yeah, I know. I knew that he has certainly got to do his work, but he's got to do his work when his client came in the office. And you can go back to the time that the information's filed, and you've seen efforts on that time to question whether or not the affidavit for leave to file is correct, or you've questioned whether or not before I adjust the peace, probable cause was shown and caused a transcript to be made, and you've argued that. And that's all part of the tools of trade. But the real question is, has he committed himself then? No, he really hasn't, because if he doesn't do it then, he's not going to be able to do it. So that's just part of the process.
He could shift it all entirely. He could change his whole strategy.
Of course he could.
Why should the so-called valued right of the defendant to go to trial before the first jury depend entirely on when the defendant's lawyer has committed himself, as you put it?
Because I don't think his right is that valued until that point. Lord Cook's rule, if you've read any of the biographies on Lord Cook, he never gave any reasons for his rules. If they took out all the rules that he gave with no reason, they would lose 75% of the English law. But his rules have been good, so how do we find out what the reason is that gave this valued right? And that's where we came into this case.
Well, what I'm asking you to do is to perhaps do what Lord Cook didn't and supply a reason for the statement you make that the commencement of the defendant's valued right begins with the point when the defendant's counsel has committed himself. Why should that be?
Because once he has tipped his hand to the prosecution on something that the prosecution does not know where he's going to go, then if he gets a retrial on that point, there's nothing left for the defense to have. It's already been run. There's no spontaneity. The second trial, and I use as an example where there is a hung jury, so it is a clear rerun of the whole show, and that defendant's chances at that time, Justice Rehnquist, are just simply zilch. There's no secret. The prosecution knows where the defense counsel's going. Those witnesses that were there to testify that the defense counsel shredded on cross-examination now get the shading that's indicated by Judge Leventhal in the Carsey case, and it's just a different trial, and the defendant's chances are seriously enhanced.
Yet, with many hung jury cases, that's the classical reason for granting a mistrial and permitting the prosecution to start over again.
Yes. I know that, because there is no reasonable alternative. The alternative, as pointed out in the Arizona case and prior to that, is you're going to put some sort of influence in those jurors to come out with some verdict rather than a mistrial, and that's not fair. But just because we don't like that aspect of it, I read this in the valued right definition or reasons given in the Arizona case, this possibility that you may convict an innocent man, that's where it comes, is that chance that he's going to tip his defense and then it runs again. And that may well be an innocent man. But I don't see anything significant about the defendant's right or anything else until that point when he has tipped his hand.
And you say that never occurs until the first witness is called.
It can't occur until that time unless he wants to voluntarily go out and do something to tip his hand, which would include making an opening statement of what he's tipping.
And he can always save that opening statement in both federal and in Montana courts until he's ready to open.
That's correct.
Mr. Keller, could I ask you one more question? You said at the outset that, of course, you didn't have the benefit of Arizona against Washington when you filed your briefs, and that you had, if you had, that kind of decides the whole case. But do you think Arizona against Washington helps you or hurts you? I'm not quite sure I understand your position.
I don't know either. I wanted to make that clear. I said that you could read this later the same way Donham's being read to say, well, if it happens when the prosecutor made his opening statement, that's before my point in time and we're in trouble. But on the other hand, this court had to know this case was pending, and this court did not say, as it has said in the past, jeopardy attaches when the jury's sworn. And when you assiduously did not say that, I have to believe that you're leaving open this very question we're here today on. And I think that hinges on what is the valued right and when should it have constitutional protection.
Very well, Mr. Keller. Mr. Keller.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. With the Court's permission, there are two issues in this case that I don't intend to discuss. The first is the question of manifest necessity. As we noted in our opening brief, the record in this case doesn't permit a determination of a number of factors essential to a resolution of the manifest necessity issue, since it doesn't indicate whether appellees resisted the amendment of count two of the initial information or whether they objected to the dismissal of that count or to the dismissal of the remaining counts. In any event, the State appears to have abandoned that issue in this Court. The second question, that I don't plan to address at any length, is whether the state should be free to adopt a rule for the attachment of jeopardy that differs from the rule applicable in federal courts. This is not a matter in which the federal government has a substantial interest. It is our view, however, that there is little to justify a disparity in the rule as applied in state and federal courts. The double jeopardy prohibition of the Fifth Amendment is, of course, fully enforceable against the states through the 14th Amendment, and the time when jeopardy attaches would appear to be an essential ingredient of the double jeopardy guarantee rather than a mere incidental or procedural feature that may be varied without doing damage to the basic constitutional right.
You're more or less just volunteering this. It's of no concern to the United States as a litigant, I take it.
Well, the issue that's of concern to the United States is when does jeopardy attach as a matter of constitutional law. If the court were then to hold that the states may be free to vary, if that portion of the court's opinion would be of no substantial interest to the United States. I'd like to limit my discussion then to the essential question posed by the court in its order of December 5th. That is, when, as a matter of constitutional mandate, does jeopardy attach? Now, at common law, as Mr. Keller has indicated, indeed, even today in England, jeopardy did not attach until verdict. The historical record leaves little doubt that this was the understanding of the framers of the Fifth Amendment and that the double jeopardy clause was not originally intended to bar the re-prosecution of a defendant whose first trial was aborted for whatever reasons prior to verdict. Despite this background, it's settled today that the double jeopardy clause is more than a mere constitutionalization of res judicata principles plus a prohibition of government appeals from acquittals. The clause also protects a defendant's, quote, valued right, as this court has said on a number of occasions, to have his trial completed once it's begun. In other words, a right to go to verdict and perhaps to end the dispute then and there with an acquittal. Obviously, in order to protect the defendant's interest in receiving the verdict of the first fact finder and hence in avoiding repetitive trials, jeopardy must attach at some point prior to the verdict. The question then is, at what point in a criminal proceeding does the defendant's interest in going forward with the trial to its completion and in not being required to begin anew become sufficiently substantial to support the conclusion that jeopardy has attached, and accordingly that subsequent trial terminations must be judged under the unyielding requirements of the double jeopardy clause? In fixing this point, we believe that the court should be guided by three considerations. First consideration, which was alluded to earlier by Mr. Justice Stevens, is that the time of attachment of jeopardy should represent a bright line. This is an area in which the need for certainty and predictability is especially important, unless the point at which a defendant has been placed in jeopardy can be identified with precision in every trial. Judges would be forced to guess as to the propriety of terminating the proceedings prematurely in a situation perhaps not amounting to a manifest necessity. An incorrect assessment may lead to immunity for a defendant whose guilt is capable of establishment. For these reasons, we doubt that the tests offered by the state in this case, which appears to depend first upon the sufficiency of the evidence that had been introduced and now when the defendant's lawyer may have committed himself in some way, or in Professor Schulhofer's recent article, which was relied on by Appellee Klein, which depends in part upon a necessarily subjective view of the difficulties encountered at voir dire, doubt whether either of those tests would be workable. Second, we believe that jeopardy should attach at the same point in jury and non-jury trials. As this court observed in Jenkins, the double jeopardy clause nowhere distinguishes between jury and bench trials. A defendant's risk of conviction is precisely the same in either type of trial. And whether the fact finder is the judge or the jury, defendant has the identical Fifth Amendment interest in completing the trial, hopefully with an acquittal, once it's begun. Finally, the point that's selected for the attachment of jeopardy must be responsive to the evils of re-prosecution that the double jeopardy clause was historically designed to prevent. That is, the anxieties, the strain, and expense suffered by a defendant who is forced to undergo repetitive trials, the possibility of manipulation or harassment by a prosecutor, particularly the chance of a second opportunity to convict the defendant if the first trial is viewed as proceeding unfavorably. Now, with those three underlying principles in mind, the United States believes that the Constitution does not require jeopardy to attach in any case, state or federal, jury or non-jury, until the fact finder first begins to receive evidence. Only when the government begins to meet its burden of establishing beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant committed the crime charged can it truly be said that the defendant faces the risk of conviction. And it's the risk of conviction, as this Court stated in Breed against Jones, that the constitutional concept of jeopardy connotes. The point at which evidence going to the general issue of guilt or innocence is produced marks a convenient and, we believe, logical boundary in every criminal case, separating pretrial preliminaries, which concededly do not deserve the protections of the Double Jeopardy Clause, from the trial itself. The rule that jeopardy attaches when the fact finder begins to hear evidence, which is, of course, the rule that has traditionally been applied in bench trials, fully accommodates a defendant's Fifth Amendment interest. Prior to the introduction of evidence, the defendant's interest in avoiding re-prosecution ordinarily is very weak. He's not yet suffered any of the strains or emotional distress associated with being forced to undergo a criminal trial. Moreover, a defendant has little, if any, stake at that pre-evidentiary stage in proceeding to a verdict in order to preserve any fact findings that the finder of fact may have made in his favor.
What about his interest in the particular jury that he is that he has chosen then, that is now sworn and is ready to hear evidence?
We don't believe that the interest in preserving a particular jury for non-evidentiary reasons is an interest that's protected by the Double Jeopardy Clause.
What do you mean, non-evidentiary reasons? He wants it because he thinks this is the jury that would do best with the evidence that he's going to introduce.
Well, the first objection is that that's highly speculative. At least when evidence begins to be introduced, we can assess what sort of impact it might be having.
It may be speculative, but the defendant has spent a long time picking the jury, and he thinks he's got a good one. And of course, before it's sworn, I suppose you could say if something blew up the trial, there wouldn't be any double jeopardy attached. But once it's sworn, the jury process is completed, and he's sworn, and here is a jury that the defendant's counsel is convinced is going to be a very biased jury. He's convinced he'll be biased in his favor. You can't say that isn't a substantial interest, can you?
Well, I can say it's not a substantial interest protected by the Double Jeopardy Clause. I can agree with you, Mr. Justice White, that it may be a substantial interest of the defendant that's entitled to protection, perhaps even a constitutional protection. And if, for example, a prosecutor sought to abort the trial after the jury had been selected but before evidence began because he thought that the finder of fact would be unduly favorable to the defendant, there might well be remedies for a defendant in that situation, either under the jury trial clause of the Sixth Amendment or the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment.
But does the Constitution guarantee the man a favorable jury or a fair jury?
Obviously, guarantees him a fair jury.
Well, the defendant is convinced that he's very convinced that this is an impartial jury, and sometimes this lawyer knows there haven't been impartial juries, and he thinks he's got one now, and he'd like to keep it.
I'm not disputing that that may be a substantial interest of the defendants. I think the task for this Court is to determine whether that's an interest protected by the Double Jeopardy Clause instead of perhaps the jury trial clause or the due process clause. I think there's substantial evidence that it's not an interest protected by the Double Jeopardy Clause. For one, as you alluded to a moment ago, Mr. Justice White, if the prosecutor at voir dire or when the venire comes into the courtroom or even after the jury has been selected but before it's been sworn does something to abort the trial because he thinks that the jury is unduly favorable to the defendant, there's absolutely no double jeopardy analysis of his actions. Although there may
well be. That depends on when you decide double jeopardy, when you decide jeopardy attaches.
Well, the law has developed in the last 200 years to now, the current understanding, which I assume this Court is prepared to reassess in this case.
You want it reassessed, maybe we should reassess it forward.
I think that the Court should reassess the entire area and decide where logically, in light of the history of the Double Jeopardy Clause, the
It makes more sense. What you've said, it makes more sense to move it forward to the when you begin voir dire later.
Well, I think it should be obvious, I think, to the Court at this point that based upon how the Court defines the interest protected by the Double Jeopardy Clause, it becomes relatively easy to fix the point for the attachment of jeopardy. In other words, if the Court finds that the Double Jeopardy Clause in fact protects defendants' interest in favorable jury selection, then jeopardy should obviously attach at or prior to the selection of the jury.
But you said one of the interests protected is to save the defendant from money, anxiety, and time of going through it twice.
Going through a trial twice.
Going through a trial twice. We're going through a criminal proceeding twice, and it may take a couple of weeks to select a jury.
It may be. It may take several weeks to litigate a pretrial suppression motion or a number of other pretrial preliminaries, but no one's ever suggested that a defendant has a double jeopardy interest.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Well, why don't you use the word that's usually used? The judge says, is this jury satisfactory to the prosecution? Is it satisfactory to the defense? Usually. Isn't that right? Well, why don't you use the word jury that's satisfactory to the defendant instead of in favor of the defendant? Just a play on words.
I don't see any significance in the use of the...
Well, I mean, the point is that they always ask such questions, don't they?
I assume that means whether any of the litigants wants to exercise any further challenges for cause, well, not whether the litigant believes that the jury that's been selected is
particularly favorable. You don't believe that in every case the judge turns and says, is this jury satisfactory?
Well...
Doesn't he use those exact words?
I'm sure it varies from case to case, Justice Marshall. I'm not familiar with the practice in the... trial courts in every state or in the federal courts, and I don't believe that
Well, have you ever seen a trial where the judge didn't say it?
Well, I think what's important is not that the litigant has have an attempt to pick a favorable jury, but that he have attempt, as the Chief Justice said, to pick an impartial jury.
Of course, historically, the double jeopardy clause was applicable to somebody who'd been tried and convicted or tried and acquitted. He couldn't be tried again. And this business of the interest in going to trial before the same jury and so on was engrafted onto it and had quite a different history, didn't it?
Well, the history...
If one looks at the Perez opinion, as I just have, and realize for the first time there's no mention at all in that opinion of the Constitution itself, let alone the double jeopardy clause.
Well, indeed, Justice Story says that the first trial did not end in a conviction or an acquittal.
Precisely, and therefore that one can infer that from that opinion that he's saying the double jeopardy clause is inapplicable.
That's correct.
We're concerned here with something else.
Well, the purpose of the double jeopardy clause is to prevent repetitive trials. That may happen by
a conviction or an acquittal.
May equally happen, I assume, if partway down the trial, the prosecutor decides to abort it and start again.
Well,
only recently
has that thought been engrafted onto the double jeopardy guarantee.
Well, it was not until 1963 that this court recognized the defendant's interest in not having to go through it.
Right, as part of a double jeopardy interest.
Right.
And before that, it had historically been a different interest, maybe perhaps protected by the due process clause.
I think that may be right. That's correct. Although, I must say that when this notion that jeopardy attached prior to verdict crept into our law is one of the substantial mysteries of double jeopardy jurisprudence, we haven't been able to determine when precisely the thought became accepted in the United States, and those courts that have applied the notion have not seen fit to explain what the rationale is that they're using to deviate from the common law.
In the common law, as a condition precedent for any inquiry under the double jeopardy clause, there would have to have been an acquittal or a conviction.
That's correct. It would have to be a verdict.
But the government doesn't contend that that's the present state of the double jeopardy constitutional law in this country, does it?
No, it doesn't. We agree that jeopardy must attach at some point prior to verdict in order to preserve a defendant's right not to have to go through unnecessarily repetitive trials.
And the government does agree that this valued right, whatever it is protected by the double jeopardy clause of the United States Constitution.
We do. We agree that once we fix the point to which jeopardy attaches, any trial terminations after that point should be judged by double jeopardy standards.
And the government is an amicus curiae in this case.
Yes, it is.
If you give it that much weight, Mr. Keller, how do you reconcile that with what Justice Black said in Wade against Hunter? What has been said is enough to show that a defendant's valued right to have his trial completed by a particular tribunal must in some instances be subordinated to the public interests in fair trials designed to end in just judgments. If it's totally constitutional, Justice Black's statement is inconsistent, isn't it?
I think that the manifest necessity notion that Justice Black was articulating in Wade against Hunter is also a constitutional notion. In other words, merely finding that jeopardy is attached and that the trial has been aborted does not end the analysis. In order for the defendant to have been deprived of his Fifth Amendment rights, there also must not have been a manifest necessity for the trial termination. Thank you.
Mr. Leiphardt.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the appellants in this case have taken the position that the so-called valued right to a particular tribunal is not of constitutional stature, rather it is a procedural practice which has developed out of the English common law. And the appellant has concluded that this valued right to a particular tribunal does not come into play or does not attach until after the tribunal has actually heard the defendant's case. As to the double jeopardy clause, the appellant takes the position in his brief that jeopardy does not attach until after the state has presented some evidence from which the jury could actually convict the defendant. The solicitor, on the other hand, has assumed a more moderate position and has urged this court that jeopardy should attach no later than the swearing of the first witness. I submit to the court that the court's recent opinion in Arizona versus Washington contradicts both the position of the appellant and of the solicitor. In the Arizona case, the defense counsel engaged in some references during his opening statement to inadmissible evidence. And as a consequence of that reference, the trial court had to declare a mistrial at the request of the prosecution. On a federal habeas corpus appeal, this court subjected the trial court's actions to a double jeopardy analysis, a manifest necessity analysis, and concluded that there was manifest necessity for the declaration of the mistrial. The import of that case lies in the fact that the incident arose during the opening statements, and that this court decided that case on the grounds of double jeopardy, even though the first witness had not been sworn. And I submit to the court that implicit in the Arizona decision is a conclusion that federal double jeopardy had attached, at least as early as the opening statement. And of course, the opening statement is prior in time to the point which has been suggested by the solicitor, and it is prior in time to the point which has been suggested by the appellant. If, as the solicitor has argued, double jeopardy interest could not come into play.
The logic of that argument really escapes me. Supposing before trial started, the police conducted an illegal search of some kind, and the evidence wasn't introduced until just before the jury retired for a verdict. Would you say, well, the jeopardy hadn't attached because the search occurred before? You don't look at the time of the time when jeopardy attached doesn't depend on when the error was committed, does it?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying, or what I meant to say, is that the mere fact that the court looked at the double jeopardy problem and analyzed the case in terms of manifest necessity meant that double jeopardy had attached at least as early as the time the error occurred.
Single jeopardy. Jeopardy.
Excuse me, jeopardy. Well, had attached at least that early.
I just don't understand the logic, because it actually dismissed the case after two witnesses had testified. So if jeopardy attaches when a witness testifies, then jeopardy had attached when he made his ruling.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I would submit that the fact that two witnesses had testified in that case is really incidental to the decision, because the...
But is it incidental to the question whether jeopardy had attached?
No, it isn't. That's what's being argued. But in that particular fact situation, the error arose during the opening statement, and that was the sole basis of the declaration, I think, of the declaration of mistrial.
That's true.
But the judge didn't declare the mistrial until two witnesses had testified.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think that the fact that he grounded that decision upon the defense counsel's improper references during opening statement indicates that jeopardy had to have attached at least that early. If it hadn't attached at the time the opening statements were made, the trial judge could have dismissed the case immediately upon the request of the prosecution.
Well, how about the several other cases where defense counsel did not make an opening statement?
Hypothetical, Your Honor, where the defense counsel reserves?
Yeah.
And you're asking when would jeopardy attach in that? Well, if I might backtrack, I'm not suggesting that the Arizona case specifically sets the time when jeopardy attaches as the opening statement. I'm just saying that as a minimum, it says that it had to have attached at least as early as the opening statement. But
supposing this prejudicial argument had been made during the voir dire, which could have happened, he could have made some prejudicial remark, would you say jeopardy therefore had to attach during voir dire?
No, Your Honor. I think that the triggering factor is going to be the point in time at which the particular tribunal comes into existence. We're talking about a valued right to a particular tribunal. And I'm not going to argue to this court that jeopardy can attach, that the valued right has any meaning prior to the time that that particular tribunal is even in existence. I think that that's the event which triggers the valued right.
But what is it in Arizona in versus Washington that makes you say it has come into existence at the point that the jury is sworn?
I don't think the case goes that far, Your Honor.
I don't either.
I think it only goes as far as saying is that it has attached at least as at the time of the opening statements. It doesn't say how far in advance of that time.
Well, but I don't think then you've satisfied me as to my brother Stephen's earlier question that supposing in mid-trial, after several witnesses have sworn, the trial judge grants a motion to suppress evidence as a result of illegal conduct that took place 4 or 5 weeks before the trial. Now, surely you're not going to say that the jeopardy attached at the time that search and seizure took place.
You? No, Your Honor, I'm not. I don't think that's consistent with the valued right concept. Obviously, the jury, the particular tribunal, was not in existence at the time the motion to suppress was made. But what I'm saying that I think Arizona stands for is that if jeopardy had not attached prior to the swearing of the first witness, I don't think the trial judge would have even had to concern himself with the defendant's valued right to proceed. He could have declared the mistrial without any concern at all for manifest necessity.
But he granted it when two witnesses had been sworn and testified.
Well, I think that he was merely taking the prosecution's motion under advisement while he had a chance to look up the law on the matter. And I don't think that the fact those two witnesses...
Meanwhile, jeopardy had attached.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, in the state of Arizona that it attached at the beginning of the opening statements. But I don't think that the Arizona law controls when federal double jeopardy attaches. Arizona falls right in between the two points that are being argued in this case. But I don't think that's a controlling factor in that case, in the Arizona
really,
decision.
I think all you're saying is that the trial judge who had to make the ruling was considering the fact that jeopardy had attached at the time of opening statements, but that was either as a matter of Arizona law or perhaps even as his understanding of the Constitution. But that really doesn't
Well, it may have been his understanding of Arizona law, Your Honor, but for purposes of the Arizona decision in this court, that was a question of federal law, because this court in Jorn and in Surfass has stated that the attaching of jeopardy rule indicates the point in time when constitutional policies are brought into play. And I don't think we can have the state of Arizona or the state of Montana or any other state telling the United States Supreme Court when constitutional policies are brought into play. That's why I say I think it's implicit in that decision by the mere fact that the court engaged in a double jeopardy analysis. There is implicit a conclusion that federal jeopardy had attached. There are, I think, two other points which have been raised by my adversaries, which are answered in the Arizona opinion. First of all, the appellant has taken the position that the valued right to a particular tribunal is not part of the double jeopardy clause, that it's a common law rule of procedure. And I would bring the court's attention to Justice Stevens' unequivocal statement in the Arizona opinion, where he points out that the double jeopardy clause embraces the defendant's valued right to have his trial completed by a particular tribunal. And I think in light of that, there's no question. But
now, well, that goes back to Jorn, which in turn goes back to Hunter, I guess.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think that
doesn't mean
that
it's sound necessarily. I mean, it doesn't mean that the two concepts don't have different historic origins.
In fact, I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think they do.
Right.
But that it has been engrafted onto the double jeopardy clause.
And Wade against Hunter was a jury case? Or
Your Honor, Wade against Hunter was a court-martial case. And I think that there can be certain analogies drawn between that and a jury trial because the defendant in a court-martial does have some say in the picking of the fact-finder. At least, as I understand it, he can exercise some challenges for cause, and I think he can also exercise one peremptory challenge.
But he didn't in World War II.
That no one has ever done it.
I don't know,
because
Your Honor.
It's not healthy.
But there's no real analogy between the composition of a court-martial and the composition of a jury of 12.
Just to the very limited extent that the defendant does have some say-so in picking the fact.
Theoretically.
Yes. The solicitor seems to argue, at least in his brief, that the Double Jeopardy Clause, the sole purpose of the Double Jeopardy Clause, is to protect the defendant from multiple exposures to the risk of conviction. And certainly the Double Jeopardy Clause does protect that interest. But I think that this Court, in a number of opinions, up to and including the Arizona opinion, has taken great pains to point out that the clause also protects the defendant's valued right. And when the Court says the valued right to proceed before that particular tribunal, that includes at least three other interests. It protects the defendant from the danger of having to engage in a prolonged period of financial and emotional burden. It protects the defendant from a prolonged period of stigma, which results as a consequence of pending criminal charges. And finally, and very importantly, it prevents the state from using the jury as a prosecutorial tool, that is, replacing one jury with another jury when it appears that the state will be unable to convict. On three separate places within the Arizona opinion, the court states that every and any mistrial declaration inevitably affects the defendant's constitutional rights under the valued right concept. And I emphasize the words any and every mistrial declaration because I think that the use of those words points out that the interests which are being protected do not hinge upon in any way the swearing of the first witness. We're talking about interests which come into play as soon as that particular tribunal has been impaneled. The fact that the witness is sworn in really is of no consequence in terms of the interests which come under the valued right.
How in the world can a man be convicted if no evidence is put against him?
Well, he can't, Your Honor, but I...
Well, then how is he in jeopardy?
Well, I'm saying that this Court has interpreted
the... We discussed that the last time, but nobody has raised that point this time.
Well, in terms of actually being convicted, he's not in jeopardy, but I think this Court has interpreted the Double Jeopardy Clause as including a valued right to proceed before the jury first impaneled. And I think that interest attaches immediately upon the impaneling of the jury. We're talking about something broader than just the mere risk of conviction.
But we're talking about a possibility of 2 or 3 minutes, too.
Well, I think that depends on the particular case we're talking about. It's conceivable that the jury could be impaneled on a Friday afternoon. You could have a weekend recess. Opening statements may take a long time. Defense counsel, as well as the prosecution, may make motions.
And it also could be a case to try early on Monday morning.
That's correct. It may be a matter of seconds.
And both sides waive on the statement.
That's correct.
That wouldn't be much good, would it?
What wouldn't be much good, Your Honor?
The 1 minute.
Well, conceivably, the prosecutor can still stand up and move to dismiss the jury, even though he's only got 1 minute to do it. I think his motives are going to be pretty transparent, but he can do it.
I'm talking about the average trial. The difference, you say it has to be one witness sworn.
Well, no, I'm arguing against that position, Your Honor. I'm just saying that I don't think the fact that a witness has been sworn.
I mean, that's the government's position.
That's correct.
That's right. It's one witness sworn.
Right.
And you say no, once the jury is impaneled.
Correct.
And that could be just a few minutes.
Between those two points.
Right.
Yes.
It could be.
Could be.
Mr. Liebhardt, I'm still a little puzzled. Let me ask what I asked you last time. Why are you here? Isn't Klein out of this case now entirely, and isn't the case mooted to him?
Your Honor, Mr. Klein is out of jail. I have not briefed the question of mootness. As I answered last time, I think that Mr. Klein's interest in this case lies in the fact that should this Court reverse the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, there's the very clear possibility that the state, if it wants to, then can re-prosecute him on some of the other seven counts which were involved in this case. He has a very definite interest in seeing that the decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is affirmed. He is the appellee in this case. I'm here merely representing him The state is the one that has chosen to appeal, and from that I gather that they still have an interest in prosecuting Mr. Klein. In this court, I can't cite the cases to you right now. I've got them in my briefcase, if you would like, but the court has held on two different occasions, I think, that the remedies available under the habeas corpus statutes are broader in scope than merely releasing a man from prison, that it can rectify the situation at hand.
Well, we're familiar with those cases, but I just wondered what substance is left in your case.
My time is up. Thank you.
Mr. Moses.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. May I suggest to the court a different area for discussion? Justice Stewart brought up the issue of the origin of the valued right. I think that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution is one of the important issues in this case. I think the question that is raised here, where it says that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, that the history of that amendment in 1866, well, through the Adamson case of Justice Black, which started the incorporation theory, is a relevant issue here. Should the court adopt a position under the 14th Amendment that the states should follow case by case, jot by jot, under the incorporation theory?
Justice Black wrote a dissenting opinion.
Yes, he wrote a dissenting opinion, and what he did in the dissenting opinion, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, was to set forth all of the congressional proceedings where Bingham, the congressman in 1866, said, I wrote this 14th Amendment because of the case of Barron versus Baltimore, which said simply that the first 8th Amendment applied only to the federal government. So that the construction of the 14th Amendment, I think, has a measure of importance here. The reason that I say that, because if it is in origin a privilege or immunity that is not rare or abstract, but is something that is recognized by the courts, then that is something that should be enforced under the 14th Amendment. I raise that issue because I think that then the federal and the state would have the same privileges and immunities. It would be consistent with the Supremacy Clause, as we understand it, the law of the land. The bench and the bar would know exactly what the rule was, and I think that that's important. The reason that I mention that is because of the second issue under the 14th Amendment, and that's not the privileges and immunities, but is the due process section. And it seems to me, as I read the cases, that we will apply to the states through the 14th Amendment those constitutional rights the court deems fundamental and thus apply federal statutes. It's a selective incorporation as I see it. It seems to me that Benton versus Maryland, which is an important case on the issue of jeopardy, raises that issue of selective incorporation. In other words, what we're saying is that under the due process of the 14th Amendment is that double jeopardy is a fundamental right. We can agree upon that. But that's not the end of the inquiry. Is the time it attaches simply non-constitutional baggage if we're going to be selective in our incorporation of the first 8 amendments? And, of course, that raises the question of whether it is implicit in the right given. I like to use the word parsing or pick apart. Jeopardy attaches when the jury is impaneled and sworn. If you just say jeopardy attaches and leave out when the jury is impaneled and sworn, then I think the language is meaningless. Doesn't make sense. You're going to have to say that jeopardy attaches either when the jury is impaneled and sworn to make it complete, or when the state says it does, or when the first witness. So that I think it is implicit even under the selective incorporation rule. There's been a lot of opposition to this incorporation doctrine. Justice Stewart has written upon it. One of the things I think has to be decided is whether we're going to reject the incorporation theory entirely under the 14th Amendment. And I think that's relevant to this particular decision. The first eight amendments are only applicable to federal proceedings, period. Any schoolboy knows that. States, you may adopt a rule that states may adopt any standard they wish, subject only to the strictures of their own state law or constitutions and the fundamental fairness test. You may want to adopt that. Now, if that's done, it seems to me that we have a chancellor's foot standard, and we're going back to Palco and Twining. I think those are the issues, in my judgment, in this case, is the application of the due process clause, whether we're going to have complete incorporation, selective incorporation, or rejection of the incorporation doctrine. One of the difficulties, if I may add this to my argument very briefly, is that there is great uncertainty in the law. Lawyers don't know how to advise their clients. Lawyers don't know how to argue before the courts because they simply do not know what the law is. That's why I think there should be some certainty in the law. We have in Montana, for instance, take Winship on reasonable doubt. It's a requirement. In Montana, we don't have that rule. We have a different rule, a high probability of its existence as to one of the essential elements. Which rule do you follow? We have the presumption of innocence. We have U.S. versus Castles, which is a federal case in which I was involved in. We have a statutory silences waiver provision, in my view. We've had difficulty, and I've had difficulty in another state with Brady versus Maryland. The court has simply said, we do not accept Brady. We don't accept it because our statute doesn't provide for it. It took 2 months to try almost. The case was finally reversed on the basis that the Supreme Court finally straightened out the district court on Brady versus Maryland. We are eliminating, have legislation to eliminate search and seizure in the state of Montana. Almost got by in the last legislative session.
What do you mean by that, eliminate search and seizure?
Well, eliminate the provisions of the Fourth Amendment. I want to be very dogmatic about that. I'm not talking about eliminating the remedy of the exclusionary rule.
You said eliminate search and seizure.
I'm saying eliminate search and seizure. Now, that's my opinion, my judgment.
So there'll be no searches and no seizures in Montana?
There'll be there will be no penalty as far as due process is concerned with respect to how the evidence was obtained in the courts in Montana.
No exclusionary rule?
No exclusionary rule. It may be a good idea, but the rule is, the question is that we go from the very basic discovery, reasonable doubt, presumption of innocence, burden of proof, search and seizure. The rule in the state of Montana is entirely different, and we don't know, as practicing attorneys, what rule do we follow? Do we follow the federal rule because it is a matter of constitutional importance under the Supremacy Clause? Or do we follow the state statute? It is a difficult problem from my point of view. Now, finally, to end my statement, because I wanted to address the court's attention simply to the 14th Amendment, let me end by saying that I disagree with my friend, Mr. Keller. In the last 2 years, I have decided that I make all opening statements at the beginning of the case. I just had a murder case with a battered woman syndrome, and I wanted the jury to hear about the battered woman syndrome at the earliest possible time before the shooting in the back testimony came to the fore. Had a good reason for it, but I am now almost exclusively making opening statements. Secondly, it is true in the practice in Montana that the judge is now permitted to give instructions to aid and assist the jury in the fair consideration of the case as they sit there. And that is a good idea. And that occurs before the first witness is sworn. My conclusion to the court is this. The rule, I think, is of constitutional significance. As a matter of fact, what I'd like to do, if I may, let me read you an opinion and order that I think would be appropriate in this case. The Double Jeopardy Clause of the United States Constitution is a fundamental constitutional right. Jeopardy, as we have said, attaches when the jury is impaneled and sworn, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding, the decision is affirmed. That's what I would propose. Thank you, gentlemen.
Let me ask you just one question. When you spoke of the judge giving instructions. You're speaking of preliminary, limited instructions about the burden of proof and the order of trial, not a complete instruction on the law of the particular case.
In essence, that is correct, Mr. Chief Justice. What the judge does now under the current practice is simply give the jury those necessary instructions that it feels is appropriate to guide the jury under the as it sits there. For instance, the presumption of innocence rule, and that you may not form or express any opinion as to the merits of the case, that you're the sole judges of the credibility of the witnesses, things of that kind, so they really know what they're supposed to do. But that occurs after the jury is impaneled and sworn and before the first witness takes the stand.
Very well.
May I ask this question?
Yes, sir.
My recollection is the information in this case was dismissed solely because of a typographical error in date.
No, sir.
What was it dismissed for?
That was only one of the grounds for dismissal, Mr. Justice Powell.
That was the ground for dismissal of one of the counts.
Of one of the counts, yes, sir.
Right.
There were five other counts that were good.
Right, well, Judge Tuttle characterized that, as I recall, as a tactical stroke. Were you counsel at the time?
I was counsel at the time, and it was not a tactical stroke, sir.
May I ask what prompted you to wait until after the jury was sworn?
Let me tell you exactly what happened. I had raised the issue as to the whether the offenses or any of them stated a criminal offense as to all of the counts. I had raised substantial objections, and they were overruled without the court ever reading the brief. At once the jury was impaneled and sworn, I raised that same issue again, the same issue, and I still contend that there were not sufficient grounds to state a public offense as to all of the counts. At that particular time, I think they moved to amend to have a particular date. And, of course, I objected. But my objection, and I also requested at that time that we go to the Supreme Court and have this all resolved, but the Supreme Court, when the application was made by the Attorney General to go to the Supreme Court after they refused to allow the amendment and some other changes, the Supreme Court refused and said, go back and try it. Then they came into court and say, we're going to dismiss them all of them. I think there were five other good counts at least. We're going to dismiss them all and start in again. And the record is plain that I objected in writing. I didn't object in writing. The record is clear that I objected at that time. So it was not, to that extent, a tactical maneuver on my part, Mr. Justice Powell. I was there because the charges were not any good in my judgment, and I wanted to go to the Supreme Court to prove that. The Supreme Court wouldn't hear it, and during that course of time, they moved to amend, and, of course, I objected then to them doing anything. And that's the way it occurred.
Mr. Moses, to follow up on Justice Powell's question, in your judgment, if the case had gone to trial on the original counts and there'd been a verdict of guilty, would there have been reversible error in the record?
In my judgment, yes.
And then what would have happened? Then if that had happened, then there would have been a reversal and a new trial, wouldn't
you
it?
You bet. That's exactly correct.
So your client would have had to stand trial twice if you're...
That is precisely correct, sir.
Well, then how is your client, in terms of double jeopardy policy and valued right and all the rest that we've been talking about, how was your client hurt at all by having the dismissal take place right at the outset of the proceeding instead of going through a whole trial and appeal and ending up in the same place?
I have a personal prejudice about that, sir. In my opinion, being the trial counsel, the reason overall that it was dismissed, they had five other good charges, the reason that it was dismissed is that the prosecution felt they had a lousy jury. I thought we killed them on voir dire as to what the issues were, and that we had a good jury. This is at the Capitol, where you have state employees and things of that kind. And in selecting the jury, I thought we had a good jury. I think the prosecution thought they had a lousy jury.
You didn't have a good enough jury to insist on your right to. Did you want to go to trial on that? I'm trying to remember now.
Yes.
You did, yeah.
Yes, I was insisting we go to trial. I raised my objections. Judge turns me down.
I thought you moved to dismiss.
I thought you'd move to dismiss the
Oh, yeah, yes. I had moved to dismiss because of the fact that they didn't state a public offense.
Right. And you objected also when counsel for the state wished to correct.
Oh, yes. Yes, sir, I sure did. That's exactly what I did. It was my judgment at that time that those counts did not state a public offense, and I moved to dismiss at every stage of the proceeding. If I'd had jeopardy in mind, I would have waited until the first witness was sworn. I wouldn't have raised the issue then. Been silly.
But you were not insisting on going to trial. Very understandably, you were doing everything you could to get the indictments dismissed, so you wouldn't go to trial.
You bet. Yes, I was trying to get the every stage of the proceeding. Right. I was objecting, and that was my purpose. Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Keller?
I don't think I saved much time, Mr. Chief Justice.
You have 3 minutes left.
The weight against Hunter, Justice Murphy, with Justice Douglas and Justice Rutledge agreeing in dissent, said in the first paragraph, "We agree with the court below that in the military courts, as in civil, jeopardy within the meaning of the Fifth Amendment attaches when the court begins the hearing of evidence." I don't think there's any question that court-martial that you weren't talking about a jury or picking a jury. Mm-hmm. That was prior to 1951, and you just know they didn't have juries. Right. That's correct. The only other points are just in passing. Any opening statement that my colleague, Mr. Moses, makes to a jury doesn't tell the prosecution anything, period. I know that it doesn't, and he might have a battered woman syndrome, he might have anything else, but he doesn't tell the prosecution anything, not uncommonly, not until on appeal, frankly, so, yeah, there's
Mr.
no
Keller,
problem there.
Mr.
And we don't
Keller,
have that backward
Keller,
estate.
May I ask you a question, please? Just on the point that Justice Powell and I were inquiring of your adversary, what is the state's position on whether or not there was manifest necessity, just so we have it clear on the record?
At that particular time?
Yes.
I didn't think that there was a manifest necessity
You're
case, and I can recall Justice Rehnquist asking me, maybe you might and would disagree, and that's well taken, but at that particular time, and we didn't participate in the trial of this, at that particular time, you had 3 counts that were defective just because of a typographical error. What Mr. Moses is talking about is he thought all 9 were defective, aside from the typographical error, just as a matter of law.
That they didn't charge criminal offenses
That's
under
correct.
Montana law.
But as to these 3 counts that had to get thrown out, they charged an offense that wasn't an offense any longer.
Right.
The law had changed in Montana. The Criminal Code of 73 took effect on January 1, 74, and these 3 counts said the crimes in 1973 language occurred in January and February of 74. Well, they could go to trial, they could go anywhere, and they could never convict on that.
So
but you did make a good point, and Judge Bennett will never make the mistake again. He'll grant the amendment, have the trial get reversed, and we'll try it again. We won't talk double jeopardy.
So
and you know, that's
is it
terrible.
Clear then, I just want to be sure I understand. Is it clear then in the state's view that the trial judge had power to amend the counts and there was no necessity for a dismissal? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think that he did have that power. I think that change was substantive. And our statute at that time prevented a substantive change. You were going to charge the defendant with picking up an extra year of time to defend on its face. Not really, but you were. On its face, it was there.
Let me ask the same question again. In your view, was there or was there not manifest necessity for dismissal of the charges?
To dismiss those charges? Well, yes, I think there was. On those 3. But not on the remaining 6.
I see. So the remaining
That's where the hang-up came, and he got convicted, ultimately, of one of the 3 that was corrected. He got charged at the second trial with one of the 6 that wasn't affected and one of the 3 that was corrected and found guilty of one of the 3 that was corrected. Prosecution at that time didn't want to go ahead on those 6 because they weren't that good, but they would have sure come under ash against Swenson. It would have been collateral estoppel, cold as a wedge, because it all took this same period of time. They all had to do with one woman and one transaction, literally. They were a spread eagle at the time, whether they knew it or not. And it may not have been a tactical stroke, but I'm sure it was an awfully smart move.
Thank you, Mr. Keller.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.